co-host and friend, Shelly, and our extra special guest, the one and only Jeremy Johnson. There is such beautiful stuff in this episode. I cannot wait for you to hear it. Jeremy explains not just that he got through depression and to a better place where he was grateful, but how he did it. And what's fascinating to me is it is very similar to when I went through my stuff when I was after having been assaulted and I was trying to find my way out of that darkness and despair. And I was looking for hope and something to hang on to. And the thing that Jeremy grabbed hold of and that I found also was gratitude. And which tells me truth is truth. Whether we all have different roads when we get somewhere, but the truth is always going to be the truth. And I really, the whole purpose of the podcast, I want to educate people and entertain you while we enlighten you as to how this justice system works. But if I can help anyone get through some dark place and get to a better place, and I know that that was why Jeremy shared his story with everyone. And if anyone needs some help, I actually went in and recorded a guided meditation to help you. It's 10 minutes each morning. It's just past episode 50. I don't have it numbered, but it's called guided meditation. And it's just like two episodes after 50, although I don't call it 52, but I want to share that with you. If anyone wants help, it is just a beautiful thing that Jeremy found the same path that I did without us. I'd never talked to him about this before. You've got to hear this. I can't wait to share it with you. So here we go. I'm just going to pick up where we left off before. I was just starting to ask him about his money. So I hope you enjoy.
I don't want to be shallow, but it's so much of why this made headline news, because you were this self-made millionaire. I mean, they took hundreds of millions from you, right? At least tens of millions.
Well, I don't know. I think the end of the day, the number was like 30-something million. Hard to say, actually. Yeah.
And that's only 37 million more than I have. So it's still impressive for me. So when you set out to do the company, did you think, I'm going to create this company and get it where we're worth tens of millions, 100 million, whatever it got to?
Yeah, how did
was that
you
a goal?
Start out? Or was it just a passion you had that
no.
you thought, hey, this might be something that might work? Like, yeah, how did this whole thing start?
No, it was neither of those. It was just, we see a little problem. It's usually some annoyance that I had. And I figure if I solve the problem for myself, then probably other people have the problem and they would pay for the solution.
Gotcha.
So first thing we did was back in like late 90s, early 2000, it was easy to buy stuff on eBay, but selling was a little difficult. You had to know a little HTML. And so we just made a program that just kind of walked them through step by step how to sell your stuff on eBay and a little HTML editor and an email program.
Gotcha.
Very simple, very basic compared to what's out there now. But at the time, people found it useful.
Oh, and it was cutting edge then. Like, no one had thought that far. So that's cool.
Yeah. Then. But after a while, eBay got wise to that, made a better program for free. So problem solved itself eventually.
So when you are dealing with, and I know like the Lost Boys stuff, that came from the Attorney General Mark Shurtleff, who was the Attorney General at the time, and he asked you if you would help, knowing that you are so kind and generous, you jumped in and helped. And then that created this connection with those guys, with Shurtleff and Swallow. And I've explained most of your story, and I know you haven't listened to the podcast, and that's fine. That's
sure.
Totally fine.
PTSD.
Oh, I totally understood.
No,
yeah,
I totally understand it. And I don't blame you. I wouldn't want to go back through, because I went through every single detail, and why would you want to relive that?
No.
You wouldn't.
No.
So people understand from your perspective, you didn't seek out politicians to try to do something. It kind of worked out. They sought you guys out. And then because of that relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, they wanted money, and you were a generous guy. So that's how they connected with you initially. And then it just evolved from that.
Yeah, that's right. I always feel like the perception that people have about what I think of John Swallow or Mark Shurtleff is incorrect. I like them both. I don't think either of them are particularly corrupt, or at least not more so than any other politician.
Right.
they're in a tough spot. You know, these are pretty intelligent guys. They'd be making considerably more money in the private sector than what they were making there. And then on top of that, they got to fundraise and, you know, try and basically reapply for that job every year with the voters. And I think they did what a normal person would do that's put into that situation, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I've felt that politicians higher up the food chain were more dubious in their scheming, I guess, and than either those two ever could have dreamed of. And so,
interesting. Yeah.
And we did a lot of, get more in depth on that with Troy Rawlings. And you know, Troy, tell me, so people know, what are your thoughts and feelings about Troy Rawlings, the Davis County DA?
He's certainly a rarity among prosecutors and people hold the power to destroy a life or at least dramatically alter it. I don't think out of my whole experience I met a more principled and forthright, honest person in the legal system than Troy Rawlings.
Wow, that's a great compliment.
I totally agree.
It's true. I think most prosecutors, I don't know most, but at least some in his shoes would have really worked hard to force a case and take advantage of the sensationalism. And I never once felt pressured by him to try and bend the story a certain way. All he wanted to do was find the truth, and then whatever that led to, he was going to go with.
Right.
Regardless of what the federal government or anyone else wanted it to be, you know, that was a strange thing. It was clear that the FBI had a certain narrative that they wanted followed. And I think they assumed Troy would go along with that program. And
Very frustrating to them when he wouldn't.
Right.
I should love to see Troy in a position to be able to really influence all the justice system.
Me too.
I always thought, man, if this guy was like the Attorney General of the state or the United States, we live in a different world.
We totally would. I have said the same thing. Or even if he was just like the head U.S. attorney in the federal prosecutor's office, in the U.S. attorney's office in Utah even, would help. It would just help a lot. It seems to me that we're really short on people with integrity.
Yeah, I would feel like that him in a position like that, you would see justice getting done. Not cases getting won. But justice getting done.
And you know, we talk about peer pressure. I worked at a middle school for 30 years, so, and peer pressure is very strong in a middle school age, but we don't realize how strong it is outside. And I think sometimes when you are in a dog-eat-dog world, like attorneys can be, and you're, you know, you're fighting to survive, sometimes we forget the ethics side. Or, like you just said, it's not so much about winning as let's make sure justice is handled. And if Troy ever stepped up into that position, and like you said, the influence, sometimes we have to retrain our brain like, whoa, it's not all about winning. It's like, is justice happening? You know, it's not a scorecard. And sometimes I think we have to be retaught that, retaught our humanization.
Tell me, here's like one of the funniest things that I loved that was so crazy. Tell us your perspective when, okay, and I've shared with everyone about the plea deal and how Brent Ward and Rob Lennon put you in that room and with the hit list of, okay, either you plead or we're going after all these people. And on that list were your parents, your wife, all these people that you love. Basically anyone you care about or love that you've ever given money to, we're going to go after them unless you take a plea. And that's when you say, you break down, you say, okay, fine, I'll say whatever you want. In that meeting, and I don't know if you know in your mind, you probably do remember details of this, how Brent Ward was saying, no, do it this way. And then Rob Lennon would interrupt and say, no, he was telling Brent, you can't write that all out. You can't tell him what to do because the judge is going to ask him, or did anyone promise you anything? And we can't. Then Jeremy, if he tells the truth, he's going to have to say yes. And knowing all that, see, you are so smart. And then you walked in and everyone, like, huge deal. Jeremy Johnson is going to take the plea. And then that whole thing, will you go from your perspective on that? Do you want to share with us your thoughts as you went in there?
I'm happy to share that. Okay. Yeah. When I met with Rob Lennon and Brent Ward and these guys, I was already completely resigned to the fact I was going to take a plea deal and accept whatever the terms were. I think any normal person would do the same thing. I mean, if they have a gun to your mother's head or, you know, people you care about, I could have got Brent Ward to take the same plea deal.
Yeah.
You know, if I had that kind of leverage over him. Mm-hmm. I will say, yes, something for Rob Lennon. He was visibly uncomfortable with the whole situation. Ooh. He did not like that I was taking a plea deal where it was very obvious I didn't believe I was guilty. And,
interesting.
You know, I'm only doing it under threat of the government was going to do to the people I care about. Mm-hmm. But it was Brent Ward's case, and he was running the show, and so Rob was just kind of sitting there putting in as much of his two cents as he, I think, thought he could. And if the government would have kept their agreement, I would have taken the plea deal, and I think I would have been just fine with it.
So what part of the agreement did they not keep? Remind everyone.
Well, when we were in the plea change hearing, the judge asked if I've been made any more promises to take this plea deal. I said yes. The government's promised they're not going to arrest my mom and my brother and all these people they've threatened to arrest.
Yeah.
And Brent Ward acted like he didn't know what I was talking about, which I knew damn well he did know.
Sure,
of course. You guys had exchanged emails about it, right?
We'd exchanged emails about it. I mean, Brent Ward gave me a list with the names on it of the people he was going to have arrested.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So I just said, I just want this on the record, and I'm willing to accept this plea. I'm willing to say I'm guilty to all these things, but I need the government to be bound that they aren't going to follow through with any of these threats. And so that was it. I mean, it was pretty simple for me.
Yeah.
So I even now don't understand what's so complicated, you know?
Yeah.
Well, what's so complicated is they can't threaten
you. Under duress. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And by saying that, you just shined a big old spotlight on the shenanigans that they were doing, which was awesome.
Well, I can't imagine that he really thought I'd be like, I mean, that's what they kept saying. You're just going to have to take our word for it. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine to take your word for it, but on the record, you know, like,
yeah.
Are you going to take my,
exactly.
How about if you take my word for it that I'll go to prison, but if I decide not to, there's nothing you can do about it.
Right. Like, yeah, let's reverse it.
I'm not going to go to prison, and then you follow through on your threats, and because there's nothing on the record that you aren't going to do that. I can't do anything about it. Like, why would I do that? That doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
But I realize now they probably would have not gone after my family.
Right.
They probably really would have been over. But in my state of mind, I'd already been tricked and lied to, and they've done all these dirty things that they also weren't supposed to do. So I'm like, what's stopping them from falling through?
For sure.
Yeah, your trust level is a little shattered by
listen,
then, of course.
I'll take your word for it when you take my word for it that I'm actually innocent. Like, I'm giving you my word. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So then you do that, and that's when...
Yeah. It's thrown out, right? They were like...
No, the U.S. attorney, Dave Barlow, jumped up and ran up front, right? He's like, whoa, stop. Because they didn't want any of this going on the record.
Somebody came up from the galley and was like jabbering in Brent Ward's ear. And that just seemed to really put the brakes on everything.
And out went the plea deal, huh?
Well, we tried to work it out. We spent, geez, it seems like hours in the judge's chambers. And I just kept saying, yeah, I'm happy to do this. I'm happy to go forward, but not just... I can't just take your word for it. And that's what they kept saying. We're going to have to take our word for it.
I don't
and I'm like,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Why would I at this point? Like, I can only think of one reason why you're saying to trust you, but you want to make sure I have no way to have recourse if you don't do what you're saying. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
And even the judge was just like, oh, geez, what a nightmare this is.
Right. So crazy. There are so many crazy things, and I'm not going to make you relive them. I just want to
pick and choose.
Have you ever talked about, like, what a day in your life was like in prison? Like, what started the day and how the day ended?
No, but I'm happy to do that. And by the way, you can ask me anything. There's not a single thing I could think of that I would, like, not want to talk about.
Okay.
So don't feel afraid to ask me something. Well, here's the best way to explain it. Look at what your day is right now. It's divided up into all these little decisions that you're making. You know, your phone's getting text messages. You're thinking about what you're going to have for lunch. what, you know, maybe you got a mortgage you're wondering about paying. And it's just putting out one fire after the next, basically.
Yeah.
In prison, you don't have that. You don't wonder what you're going to have for lunch because they've already decided that for you. Mm-hmm. And you don't worry about paying any bills because they pay all the bills. Mm-hmm. And even after a while, you don't worry a whole lot about your family and everything else because there's nothing you can do.
Okay.
And you don't have Facebook or text messages or anything else, and you have no distractions. And, you know, as we go through our lives normally through each day like this, in the back of our minds, I believe, at least in mine, there are the bigger questions of what am I doing here? And what is the purpose of life? Mm-hmm. And we push those aside because those aren't the burning questions. We're worried about putting out the car payments and answering an email or whatever
hitting
it is.
Hitting snooze. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in prison, those were the things that I got to think about. And I got to spend time pondering and trying to figure out. And that was very meaningful. And I'll go back to something that Pamela said when I would email and say, I'm as happy as I've ever been. That was really pretty true in a lot of ways, because what I figured out is that happiness is a state of mind.
Okay.
We let our circumstances determine our happiness so often, but it doesn't have to be so. And Haiti played a part in that for me. I would be sitting in prison and feeling sorry for myself. And I would think back to people stuck in Haiti who are lucky if they get one stinky meal a day. Who would love to be in a federal prison getting three meals a day and love to have a roof over their heads and a bed to sleep in and to feel. So as bad as it was for me, I could always think of someone who had it worse. And so when I found myself feeling bad for myself, I would try and put those thoughts out of my head and think about anything that I could to be grateful for. Wow. Like the simplest, little, dumbest things, you know, like, oh, look, Jolly Ranchers, there's a cherry. I love the cherry. And I'd be like, you know, that would be what I would think about.
Wow.
And pretty soon you go from being unhappy and in a sour mood to all of a sudden, hey, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah.
Life's pretty good. I really don't have anything to worry about. I can just chill here. I can read books. I can go play tennis.
Oh, my gosh. And Jeremy was reading. Like, voraciously reading.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Keep going.
Were you able to journal?
It's true.
Or did you have access to, like, a pencil or a pen? Not probably a pen, but a pencil or writing or anything like that?
I had access to those things. I've just never been a writer. I don't like it for some reason. You know, I get people say all the time, hey, you should write a book. And I probably should, but I just... Yeah. Don't like it.
But like you had access in prison with it, right? It wasn't like a on the no-go.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
No. You could write. I mean, I tried a few times and I just...
Just wasn't your thing.
It just wasn't my thing. And it's part of the thing with... I don't go back and relive through a lot of my life. You know, in part of the reason I don't go listen to all the podcasts, I mean, I lived it.
Yeah,
and I saw it through a different set of eyes than what everybody else did. And so my experience was different. And I don't think about it often. I'm thinking about going forward. And another valuable thing that I got from going through that experience is I'm more careful about what I spend my time thinking about and doing. And I look at it like an investor, right? Like money in the bank.
Yeah.
You don't spend the money you have in the bank unless it gets you something. Mm-hmm. And so why do we spend so much of our time and our thoughts on things that don't get us something that we like?
Wow.
We get stuck in these ruts and we think about things that, that make us feel sad or angry or frustrated. And that's our choice. We don't have to think about those things. Mm-hmm. We can choose not to, and we can think about things that make us happy and things that we want, right? not things that hurt us and things that happened in the past. And so I'm not saying that that's what I always do, but I catch myself. If I don't feel well or I'm unhappy, I can usually identify where it's coming from. And if I'm wasting my time being upset about something or someone or something someone did or some injustice, and I'm learning to let those things go, move on, forgive. Put my energy, yes, and my time and my thoughts into something that will get me something in return that I like.
We have so much more power. We have so much more power and control over our happiness than I think anyone realizes. And I think for me, and I had to go to the really like lowest place to and climb out to learn that for myself, that I am the captain of my ship and the master of my soul. And thank you for sharing those thoughts about that, because it seems it's so simple, but it's so huge. Like, yeah, where am I going to put this bank account? Where am I going to put the most valuable asset I have is how I feel, my thoughts, my feelings. Why would I want to give that to someone else that I like? You can't give that control. It's not going to serve you well. And by focusing on that, I just am grateful that you shared that. The other big thing I want to talk about, I've shared why you went pro se, why you represented yourself in the legal field. The legal term is pro se. And I know people would love to hear, because I really believe the judges don't understand what happened, because the attorneys were all protecting each other everybody that's listened to the podcast this far has heard what happened to attorney, and I just referred to him by number. So there were eight of them
from one to four, five, six.
Yeah. So, and the people that listen know what happened to like your second public defender and your third and your fourth and fifth, and they know the inside that I shared, but the judges didn't know that. And I really think that's part of the reason that the judges were really angry at you, because I think they thought, oh, this guy, like, with his helicopter and his millions and this self-made young whippersnapper, this guy thinks that he is smarter than the rest of us and he doesn't need an attorney. But that really was not how it came down. You are so far from being an arrogant person. And I can say that because I know you, but I don't think that they got that. And I think they thought you chose to go pro se out of arrogance. And so, like, that decision, was that a hard decision for you to make?
It was, but at the end of the day, it was just the only logical choice. If Nathan Crane could have stayed on as my attorney, I'm certain that even if we would have made it to trial, we would have won. Mm-hmm. He worked hard. He was motivated. He really had a grasp and an understanding of the case. But that was the only attorney that ever represented me that I felt really did. It wasn't that the other attorneys were bad or whatever. They just didn't have the time and the resources to get into it. And maybe the motivation in some respects.
Yeah.
And so I could have either been represented by an attorney who really knew nothing about the case, wouldn't have known what to ask witnesses, but would have understood the law certainly better than me. Or I could have just represented myself, and at least I know what to ask witnesses. Yeah. You know, I know what to look for as far as finding emails and stuff like that to present as evidence. I knew what happened. So when I read the indictment, I was able to find the evidence to show that it wasn't the case. And had I had turned that over to an attorney, I don't think they would have been able to do it. They just weren't prepared. And
I agree.
So was what I didn't want to represent myself.
I know for a fact your attorneys didn't even know what the company did.
Exactly. I'm getting close to trial, and I'm saying, I remember one of them I asked, hey, what do you think the best thing is the government has against us? You know, what's the worst thing I got to worry about? She says, oh, I think, you know, the false testimonials are going to be a real problem. And I'm like, what?
What?
What do you, really? You know, like they don't even allege that in the indictment. And I've not heard there was no, we had thousands of real ones. Why would we use false ones?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, really? And so she just heard something somewhere from early on. The FTC said, oh, there's a false testimonial.
Yep.
And we pulled it out like, no, here's the email they sent us. It's real. And so I think she heard that, and that's just the best answer she had. And then I remember I said, so do you even know what we did? And she goes, something to do with mortgages, wasn't it? And I was like, oh my God, this is who's representing me. I'm going to trial in like 60 days, and this is my attorney.
I have no idea who
so
I am.
So I'm just like,
did you like throw
up? I don't have any chance. I remember feeling sick, and I was like, that's when I was like, okay, well, if I have any chance of, you know, winning this, I'm going to have, it's up to me. It's not going to be because of anything they're doing.
Wow. So another funny thing that sticks out, I'm pretty sure it was in the first week. I can't remember which, maybe you'll remember which Wells Fargo executive had just testified, and you were going to impeach them with the application because you'd read through the indictment and decided, okay, I have to have my evidence ready to prove that each of these allegations and counts in this indictment that we can account for the truth in all these. And so it was all involving the merchant account statement. And so that's when you had called the 800 number for Wells Fargo. And none of us on the defense team knew that Jeremy had done this. And he had called Wells Fargo and said, I need to get a merchant account. And he used the exact facts of your case and then said, how do I do it? And they issued you a merchant account. And nobody knows about this. And then here we are in trial, and the executive had just testified. And you pulled out this. Was it an email? I can't remember what it was you pulled out exactly. But it was basically that you had been approved for a merchant account to show them that what they had just testified of was absolutely not true, that they still practice business the same way by the time 5 years later when we were in trial. Do you remember how funny this moment? Well, it's funny kind of now.
Yeah. Yeah, he just testified that they would have never given me a merchant account if they knew all my information or whatever. And so, yeah, I just called up. I mean, here, I've already been indicted. I'm on every blacklist in the world, and they weren't happy to give me a merchant account.
Oh my gosh.
But, of course, that was not relevant to the case, according to the judge. And so that was never admitted. But
right. So Jeremy brings this up. So they call a recess, and I'm like freaking out. Jeremy walks, I don't know if you remember, you walk up to me. I think we were just outside of the bar, like on the other side of the bar. You just stepped out of the bar into like the gallery. And Jason Burke comes walking by, and you said to me, oh, were you nervous? And I said, oh my gosh, Jeremy, my heart was just pounding. Like, I didn't know that you had done this. Because of course, Wells Fargo's freaking out, their attorney's freaking out, the prosecutor's pissed. And now they're all like going, what the heck? Like, this guy charged with bank fraud is even now trying to get a merchant account? Like, what the? Like, everyone's freaking out. The tensions are so high and the judge is pissed. You can tell everyone's mad. And Jeremy comes up to me and Charlotte's standing next to me, Jeremy's wife. And he's like, yeah, were you nervous? I said, oh my gosh, are you kidding, Jeremy? Like, I was so stressed. Like, I didn't know. And he starts laughing. And right as you start laughing, do you remember Jason Burke comes by and he turns to you and he goes, oh, you think that's funny, Jeremy? And you said, yeah, I kind of do. And Jason Burke goes, oh, you think bank fraud's funny? You think bank fraud's funny?
That's and then, not even what you're
And Rich was standing next to me. Oh, no. And right. And like Jason Burke like approached you like I thought, oh, my gosh, like this is going to become violent. I wasn't worried about Jeremy. I was worried about Jason because he was so angry. Like, Jeremy, I've never seen Jeremy angry, actually.
Jason?
Oh, I've seen Jason angry plenty.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know Jason as well as I know Jeremy. But okay. I've never... And I'm like, oh my gosh. And so Rich stepped between Jeremy and Jason and he'd like told Jason, like, hey, take a break. Like step outside. And do you remember that moment, Jeremy? Is that even on your...
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh. Oh.
I vaguely remember
To me, To me, it was scary because, like, oh my gosh, now the prosecutors are even more mad. I'd never had a case that got this personal with the prosecutors and the defendant, because usually the defendant isn't talking, but it was so, so personal.
It was.
On so many levels. And it was gut-wrenching for me to watch so many people lie under oath. And then when, like, Shane Fisher and Jeremy Livingston came on the stand and were truthful, even in spite of the government threatening them also.
Yeah.
There are these moments in trial, like there were really tough moments, and then there are these moments where I'm like, wow, I see some light. There's some hope. There are good people out there. How did you pick? There's no way you could anticipate having criminal charges and them taking everything you'd created and doing what they did to your life. But for you to pick men, and I don't think we've made this clear, like Ryan Riddle actually had not even worked for your company for how many years? 2 years? 3 years at the time?
Yeah, something like that.
Like he wasn't even working for the company. And then they loop him in and charge him. And Ryan did not turn on Jeremy and say, you rotten SOB, you got, like, I never heard anything like that.
Right, right.
And you guys have all heard Scott's words, his voice. Scott has the utmost respect for you. How did you pick the men that worked with you, the people that worked with you? Because, and I know some employees turned on you, but these core guys, I love them. I love their characters.
Yeah.
I'm beyond impressed.
I do too. And I truthfully didn't know how good they actually were. You know, nobody can ever know until you get put in that situation.
Right.
And I'm even encouraging them. I'm saying, look, just tell the government whatever they want and get out of this nightmare.
Yeah.
They just weren't going to do it. Didn't feel right about it.
I've shared that many times that I would meet with you and you'd say, oh, I'm telling them to just go ahead and take a plea and say whatever they want. And I'm like, Jeremy, no, please, no, this will be so hard.
I wouldn't have blamed him for a second. I wouldn't have thought anything less of him. I would have completely understood, you know. They didn't own the company. They didn't own anything. They had nothing to gain from any kind of a fraud or anything else. And they got drug into this. And so if that's the way to get them out, that's okay, you know.
Yeah, right.
But they just weren't the character of those men and were such that they weren't okay with that. And so it does. It says a lot about them.
It says a lot about them, and it says a lot about you. That
right.
is your relationship with them. I'm impressed all the way around. Like everyone
right.
deserves a ton of credit for being the people that they are, which is amazing that you guys are some of the most impressive people I've ever met.
Well, and just like Jeremy said, you were under fire fighting for your lives.
Yeah.
Like to be able to meld and hold tight like that.
Tell me, and I've raved about Marcus, but tell me your feelings about Marcus Mumford and your thoughts.
You know, I've never met anyone like Marcus. I don't think anyone has.
Yeah.
He was fearless.
Yeah.
He was not concerned about his career, his standing with the court, his reputation. Mm-hmm. He just simply wanted a fair trial.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he wanted a fair fight. And he wanted exactly what we're taught in school that the justice system is, and where that was failing, he was trying desperately to make that up at great personal expense to himself. He's just like the juror said, you know, he's the best lawyer a person could hope to have.
Yeah.
And I knew he was a good lawyer. When we were trying to figure out who's going to have what for attorneys, mm-hmm. I specifically worked to try and get Scott Levitt Marcus Mumford, because Scott was the most scared, I guess it seems like, and uneasy about the whole process, and I felt he needed the best attorney to give him that reassurance.
Wow. That was so generous of you, Jeremy.
That he's going to be okay.
Anyone else, I think, would have kept Mumford to themselves. They would have kept Marcus and said, I'll take Marcus. You can go find someone else.
Yeah. Believe me, I wanted to.
Yeah. It's just another place.
Yeah,
where
and I met with him before he represented any of us, and I felt like, I felt like Scott was who he should represent.
Well,
but
that's insightful.
I don't want to pretend that I'm so great because I also knew I'd be benefiting from his good work with Scott.
Yeah.
And that helped a great deal in my decision to be pro se, because in my mind, I'm like, you know, I got Marcus here. He's going to be battling.
Yeah.
And I'll just kind of ride his coattails and I'll do the best I can. Had Scott taken a plea or something else, that would have been tough.
You'd have grabbed
it. I mean, I think the trial would have been come out completely different than what it did. I'm sure we would have been found
guilty. Oh, I have no doubt. I agree with you.
You know, if not everything, a lot more. And because I wasn't standing up to the judge the way Marcus was at all. I was trying to appease him and I, you know, just trying to get through it. And so.
Yeah, to have someone that would
thank goodness for Marcus.
Yeah.
You've lived through this. But if someone was starting out in a situation like this, that you were going to end up in trial, what advice would you give? Because obviously Marcus isn't around, but what do you have any advice that you would give to someone starting this, any kind of a trial?
Yes, and maybe it changes a little, but I would say even if you're not guilty of what the government's accusing you of, you probably should go in and try and work at something out with them so they can save face and, you know, you can get on with your life better.
Ooh.
I mean, it's hard to say, did Bryce do the right thing or did he not, right? And maybe he's even torn by that.
Just one sec. Let me let our listeners get up to speed. We haven't talked much about Bryce. Bryce was another employee of Jeremy's at iWorks, and he hasn't come up much at all in the podcast. Just too much to talk about. Bryce did take a plea deal when the government was pressuring him. He took a plea deal, so I never mentioned him because he never became part of trial. In fact, the government didn't even call him as a witness to testify against these guys. Sorry, go ahead, Jeremy.
So he was in and out of it so quickly because of the plea deal.
Well, he hung on till the very end, and then his attorney talked him into taking a plea, and it was hard for him. He didn't want to do it. He was pleading guilty to things he knew he didn't do. But and this is the dilemma, is that the evidence and all that doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, once the government has launched a campaign against you, they're going to follow through with that, and so you've got to make a decision. Do I want to fight them and most likely lose, regardless of whether I did it or not, and you'll be punished greatly for fighting them? Or do I want to point out to the government all the things wrong with their case and then say, I'm willing to take a plea? You know, and that's basically what Bryce did. And that's why he got a year of home confinement, even though he pled guilty to far more serious charges than what any of us were found guilty of.
Wow.
That was the reward for his, I guess, what they would call good behavior. So that's the decision you have to make. And it's a tough one. And there's not a right or wrong answer. There's a right decision for some people, and that same decision might be different for someone else. And so just help them realize at least that's what you're up against.
Well, Pam always says one of her private eye tips is, even if you're innocent, get an attorney. You want it to be able to go and have the innocence come forward and you're get an attorney no matter what.
Yes. Especially if you're innocent.
Especially, yes.
Actually, I don't just say to make sure you have a lawyer, but to make sure you have a good lawyer, one that's going to fight for you and fight for your defense.
Yes.
That's really looking out for you, that's passionate about helping you.
Yeah.
Going back to Marcus a little bit. What were your thoughts? Because I know my thoughts, and we've shared all that stuff, like when the judge was calling the U.S. Marshals in to stand on either side of him because he was asking questions, which is what his purpose is supposed to be. And then, like the day when Lacey was testifying and Marcus freaked out on Lacey's attorney, and he's like, get the F over there to the other side, because he didn't want him sitting on the defense side.
Is she the one that pled the fifth, took the fifth?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, that's Lacey.
Yeah.
So tell me, that was such madness. I've never, like, this stuff that I saw in this case, I've never seen before. And you are defending yourself. Your life is on the line. what were your thoughts when all of this was happening with Marcus and the judge, all those fireworks and Lacey's attorney and every, like, there was just so much happening, a lot.
Yeah. I remember thinking, like, I mean, this is my first trial.
Yeah.
So I'm like, are all trials like this? Is this how it always goes? You know, this is nothing like what, you know, they taught us
in
school.
It's not Perry
Mason. Right. Yeah. We never see this on TV.
But, yeah, so much of the case was theatrics. People like Lacey, who had nothing to do with anything, but instead of just, let's confront the issue head on. Mm-hmm. Because those facts aren't good for the government, they would try and find ancillary things to bring in, like Lacey, and make these pretend victims, because there aren't real ones.
Yeah.
And I remember we spent all this time, it seemed like weeks, going through all these employees, and the government had them all coached up good, talking about how they didn't know what they were doing and didn't sign any papers and everything. And then, you know, the whole time the government has all these notarized documents in their possession.
Wow.
From those very employees that were testifying that they didn't know.
Right.
Right. And what was funny to me is all this testimony was relevant.
Yeah.
It all needed to be heard by the jury. The judge thought it was important.
Yeah.
But, like, when I want to present evidence, my phone conversations with Wells Fargo, which seemed to be right at the heart of the case, you know, did we try to deceive Wells Fargo Bank? Well, these conversations would seem relevant to that. And the judges found that they were not relevant, you know. And so he was finding things relevant that had nothing to do with the case. And the things that were directly relevant to the case, he said were not relevant and were not to be admitted. So I just thought, you know, this is, it's like a canned result. It doesn't, the evidence does not matter. It's that the government can't be made to look bad or look like they've done something, they made a mistake. It's just not in the program.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, go back to your question, that's what I would tell somebody. Like, look, it's not a winnable situation.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, once in a while somebody gets lucky, but... You know, the government wins 99% or whatever of their cases. Does that mean that really 99% of the people really were guilty and did all these things the government said?
No.
Of course
not. Right.
And so you just have to realize that you aren't innocent until you're proven guilty, just like you don't have the right to your assets.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you have those rights if the government allows you. And I think in most cases, they do allow them to you. If you really are guilty and you've committed a crime and they have the evidence, they let you say and do whatever you want in trial. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't
matter. Because they're going to get you.
They're still going to get you.
Yeah.
They only have to rig it if they have the horrible case.
If the evidence shows
and
that.
Pull out all the stops.
Yep.
Yeah, but then it all comes undone. The wheels fall off. That's what happened to you. Yeah.
I am sorry to do this to everyone, but we have got to cut it for this episode. There is more with Jeremy in our next episode. You've got to hear this. Thank you for listening to Pamela Private Eye.